Hello, welcome to the Law Report. We live in a global village. Increasingly, families move from one country to another, and increasingly, nationals from different countries come together to form families. So, what happens when these marriages split up? Whose family law applies? Australia's? Hong Kong's? The UK's? Well, for women married to high-income men, if you can possibly swing it, you want your divorce finalised in London. A week or so ago, the wife of a Russian billionaire negotiated a £453 million divorce settlement. That's $792 million Australian dollars. Terence Traynor, international family law expert with Brisbane law firm Barry Nilsson, says apart from being incredibly wealthy, we don't know a lot about this family.
We don't know a great deal about how he made his wealth, but it's estimated around about $1 billion. He had access to private planes, helicopters, yachts, substantial art collection and jewellery collection.
He's described as an oil and gas trader, right?
That's correct.
Bit of an oligarch, perhaps.
That's right. So the wife was represented by Baroness Shackleton, who has previously represented Prince Charles and Paul McCartney. So very well known with dealing with big money cases. The case had seemed to have rumbled on for some time, but a couple of weeks before the final trial, it's not known why exactly the husband didn't decide to contest that hearing. But he did make a sudden decision, and the agreement reached was approximately 41.5% to the wife, £453 million.
£453 million, extraordinary.
It's an extraordinary sum, with both children having, you know, multi-million dollar property, so they certainly lived a life accustomed to that kind of wealth. So quite extraordinary in terms of even UK courts who are well known for dealing with big money cases.
The wife and the children had been resident in London for a long time, but the husband, for tax purposes, was not a UK citizen. This case is sort of, they say, is part of a pattern which is seen London become the divorce capital of the world. Why do the super rich, if they can, especially women, seek to have their divorce cases, property cases, decided in the UK?
First of all, the UK and particularly London gravitates. It's a very transitional city, and a lot of mega wealthy people live in that city. So there is a connection to start off with. Secondly, that the courts are well known for dealing with big money cases, and in particular have a reputation of being very generous to the less wealthy spouse in cases. The courts do tend to move matters along, so it is known for its clear justice system. But really, one of the hallmarks is that non-financial and financial contributions are considered equal. And so therefore, it's been said that you get the biggest dividend for your non-financial contributions in that country.
And just coming back to that Russian couple, the husband claimed special contribution. He said, look, the billion-dollar asset pool shouldn't be divided equally because, you know, really, I've done all the work and there should be an acknowledgement of my special contribution when dividing up the assets.
That's right. I mean, a number of cases, high-profile cases, have tried to run the argument of special contributions or stellar contributions, and very limited cases have got up on that regard. The courts want to, and it goes back to a case of White and White, which is the hallmark that both financial and non-financial contributions are equal. And often people who are in those stellar sort of roles can't really, you know, it's also keeping the home fires burning, supporting people through good and bad times. And that's a contribution that's recognised and should be recognised, in my view, when taking into account a financial settlement, which you've accumulated this wealth over the course of the marriage.
And how is the law in that regard different from here in Australia?
Well, the law in Australia does take into account contributions and takes into account needs. But in the UK, it needs to trump entitlements. And so if one party needs more, then the court is more minded to order, particularly if there are young children.
I understand that there's this notion of spousal maintenance, which is quite different in the UK from many other countries, including Australia. We have this idea that you should have sort of a final settlement, and maintenance doesn't play a big role these days, does it?
That's right. Long-term maintenance in Australia is very difficult to get, and you only get it in very limited circumstances. But in the UK, particularly in the London courts, joint lives maintenance is very prevalent. And joint lives maintenance will apply. So it's until effectively one of the parties dies, if the recipient of the maintenance remarries and it will cease. So it has long-lasting implications, and there's ability to capitalise that maintenance so that you can have that maintenance sort of commuted to a lump sum.
It's an interesting notion, isn't it? Because there are now moves in the UK to do away with it or move more in line with other countries like Australia, where that's become a much, much rarer occurrence.
That's right.
There was a case just in February this year involving Graham and Maria Mills. It was about maintenance. There'd been a settlement some 15 years ago where she received a lump sum payment of £230,000 and then £1,100 a month in maintenance. But then 15 years later, she came back to the court and says, look, I'm falling on hard times after making some poor financial decisions. Our adult son is still living at my home and still dependent. I need more. So what happened when she went back 15 years later to ask for an upping of maintenance?
So what the original trial judge did find, and the appeal was upheld for the wife, is that she did have a need for an extra £340 per month. The husband did have a capacity to pay that need. He still retained his business, and as I understand it, was drawing down, you know, hundreds of thousands of dividends from that company. Although 15 years later, his view very much was that I'm not there to ensure the wife's future financial needs, and she should have been more careful. But the court didn't agree with that submission and said, well, you married and that there is provision for joint lives and there was a need and he had a capacity to meet that need. So the court increased that maintenance by the need for the wife.
There was a fascinating case, Vincent and White. When they were together, they were hippies. There was one child. There was no assets at the time. They split up. They go their own way. And then many years later, the former husband subsequently makes millions in green energy. So the wife comes back to court and asks for maintenance.
That's right. They were New Age travellers, as the court refers to them. They met as students some 25 years after separation and 20 years after the divorce. And in the UK, divorce and financial claims are separate. And so whilst they were divorced, the wife's claims were still able to be opened. She did bring a claim and saying, look, I feel I'm entitled, as we have a child, to some of that money on the basis of need. She had been in poor health. The husband had made somewhere in the £50 million worth in this company. And so it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that the wife did have a right to come back and make a claim. That was settled, and the wife ended up receiving £300,000, which, given that was 25 years later, was quite staggering.
Do you think these sorts of disputes would be decided in the same way here in Australia?
Well, no, it's very different in Australia because for married couples, once the divorce is granted, you have 12 months within which to make a property claim. The court can grant special leave to allow proceedings to continue. However, in my view, after 25 years or 20 years after the divorce had been granted, it would be very difficult to see a court allowing such a claim.
It's really interesting. It comes to quite an interesting philosophical difference. You used the term before, relationship for life, maybe, whereas we would maybe have the idea that you decide everything and then you come to a resolution and then you go your separate ways and you live your separate lives. But it's maybe a different concept about marriage or relationships?
That's right. Well, I think the foundations of marriage in the UK are very strong. The institution of marriage is very strong. And they say, you know, it is a bond that you enter in for life. Also very interesting that in the UK, there is no de facto laws. There's a very common perception that there is the common law husband or wife. But I think there's some very interesting statistics saying that 60% of UK people feel that there is a common law marriage and husband and wife. However, that's not the case. And the laws are very limited in what you have to make a claim. It's under trust law, which is very complex.
Which is very different from Australia.
That's correct. Very different.
So here, if you're in a de facto relationship, you basically have many of the same rights as married couples in terms of property settlement.
That's correct.
Speaking speaking of the differences between Australia and the UK, I want to combine these two issues of divorce tourism with the super rich gravitating to London and also maintenance. And I want to talk about a case with a strong Australian dimension. And it involved a London QC who was married to an Australian who wasn't a high income earner. What happened in that case? Just a decision last year, I think, of the courts in the UK.
That's right. So as I understand, there was an agreement reached in Australia. The wife had returned to Australia with a young child. The divorce and a financial settlement was made in Australia. The wife later felt that that was not reasonable and actually applied to have that order discharged.
Now, as I understand, after the split, she gets £72,000 settlement,
correct,
property settlement. She gets £45,000 in maintenance up to 2012, and she gets £9,000 to support their child into the future, and that'll go on forever, or as long as this person remains a child. But she's now relying on state benefits and has $50,000 or pounds in debts. Meanwhile, he's living in the $1.6 million pound house in London that they had shared through the course of their marriage. So what happens at this stage? She goes back to the courts in the UK and says, look, even though we've got a settlement in Australia, I want to what? Apply more generous British law to this.
So the wife applied in the UK for effectively a top-up of the Australian order. And she didn't have much success in that regard. The courts had said that, you know, she was legally advised. She had recourse to the Australian court to try and vary the deal if it was not considered fair and reasonable. And that really courts don't like divorce tourism or concept of divorce tourism to top up or try and look at other legal systems and apply a different rule. So the court, who said that she could not make a further claim in the UK. And of course, as her lawyers have said, it has causing her great deal of hardship.
Mm. The husband argues, look, this was a really short marriage and look, I'm happy to provide child support. I just don't want to provide sort of other kinds of support. Interestingly, I think it was Lady Justice Black said, quote, this court is not here to provide a top up against every foreign divorce. And I think she even used the term divorce tourism, didn't she?
That's correct.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today, a conversation with Terence Trainor, a family law expert. He's a special counsel with Brisbane law firm Barry Nilsson Lawyers, and he's worked in both London and Australia in family law. I'm really interested, Terence, these cases in the UK, all the cases that we've been talking about so far, we know their real names, and that is so strange to Australian ears, where we have a very strong prohibition against publishing the identities of litigants in family court cases. I think the one exception is that Russian couple where the wife sought a suppression order. She said, look, there's so much wealth here that I might be a target for criminals. But all the other cases we've been talking about, the names are out there. Why is there that difference in Australia and the UK?
Well, I think particularly in recent years, there's been a lot of publicity and momentum, particularly through Houses of Parliament and Members of Parliament, saying that there should be open justice and there should be transparency so that people having these times of difficulties can understand how the law is applied. There's also a great deal of criticism that with court resources being very scarce, that wealthy couples who are seen to come into London. And for instance, there was a case which lasted for 4 years, costing legal fees in excess of £9 million. So that kind of case effectively drew a lot of resources from the legal system. And there has been a lot of outcry where the courts are struggling to deal with the day-to-day people because there's just not the resources there. And with other cuts to legal aid funding and those sort of things, is really put the spotlight on family law.
So while being the divorce capital of the world might be really good for London lawyers, effectively it's the British taxpayer who's footing the bill for the court time.
That's right.
But what about that other question of identifying by name the people who are actually litigants in family law cases? That is something which is banned and enforced by the courts here in Australia, whereas there just simply is no equivalent prohibition in the UK?
Well, the legislation provides for judges to exercise a discretion. And if there are children, or sometimes there is sensitive commercial information that can't be made public, then the court has a discretion, as in the Russian oil trader case, then the court has a power to suppress those names and those details.
But it's not automatic.
And of course, the press have always pushed very hard to have access as a matter of public policy that there's openness in the court system.
Just last week in Sydney, you had Anthony Bell, the Sydney celebrity accountant, and Kelly Landry, TV presenter, being in local court as opposed to family court. The police had sought an AVO, apprehended violence order. The court declined to uphold that AVO, and this was all over the press. What's the distinction there? Is that because it was in the local court as opposed to the family court?
It was effectively a domestic violence case, and in Queensland, effectively the legislation provides for information to remain private. In New South Wales, where this case was heard, is that it is an open court matter, and that, save for children, that the court can suppress details, but it is the reverse. It's not a presumption that that information will remain private. You have to actually seek the courts an order that that's the case.
That's really interesting. So we have different laws in different countries around divorce and family matters, that we can perhaps call them that broadly. And then even within Australia, we have differences when it comes to, say, apprehended violence orders.
Correct.
Now, we've been talking about marriages where the couple have different nationalities, and Australia's a very multicultural country. Presumably there are thousands and thousands of Australians in that boat. The kind of forum shopping issues we've been talking about in the UK, presumably they apply here as well.
That's right. I mean, in Australia, it is much easier to bring proceedings, because if you're an Australian citizen, or you're domiciled in Australia, then you can apply for divorce and property proceedings if you're married, or if you've been resident here for at least 12 months. In the UK, for instance, if both spouses live in the UK, then the court will be seized of that jurisdiction. If the what they call the petitioner, or the person bringing the divorce, is resident there and is domiciled and has been there 6 months, or is just habitually resident there for 12 months, then you can apply for divorce in that country. It's very interesting that it covers so many people in Australia who may go for work to the UK and are there for in excess of 12 months, or maybe there for 2 years. Then in my experience, a lot of cases where companies had brought their employees over from the US to the UK, during that time, the marriage had fallen apart. You know, relocation from different countries creates its own stress, and you're in a different environment. Then you may find yourself having to deal with a case in a different country and applying very different laws.
In Australia, there are a lot of Chinese Australians and a lot of people recently arrived from China. Are there a lot of family law issues around that group of people?
As I understand it, it's not uncommon for the wife and for the children to be educated in Australia, with the husband to be in either in Hong Kong or China mainland. And therefore, you have competing jurisdictions. And given the close connection and relationship Australia has with China, Hong Kong, I imagine this applies to many, many couples.
There's been an interesting case, Lan and Howe, which involves that sort of scenario.
That's right. So we don't know much about the details of the case. We do know that the husband has been in Australia for quite some time. The wife has been resident in China for some time. They have properties in China and also in Brisbane and Sydney. So the court's having this interesting issue where the Australian court has said that they will be entertaining the wife's property application, but also in China, the courts are also dealing with the divorce and financial settlement. So you have two countries having to try and separate this couple's wealth.
Terence Traynor, let's now talk about another area of family law, prenuptial agreements. Are they binding in the UK?
So prenuptial agreements are not binding in the UK. They are very persuasive. There is a very famous case of Radmacher and Granatino. Miss Madracker was a German newspaper heiress who had in excess of £100 million of assets. The husband was a French national and trader. And so there was a big dispute as to whether a prenuptial agreement should be upheld in the UK. The courts ultimately found that the prenuptial agreement should be held in this particular instance. But it really depends. And when you're acting for clients in the UK, the courts have power to effectively strike them down if they're not fair or do not meet the reasonable needs of a party. And for people who have significant wealth, then ideally, you will make generous provision because you don't wish to be in the circumstances, for instance, the city trader we talked about earlier. It may have been a very different settlement if they had a prenuptial agreement at that time.
Prenuptial agreements here in Australia, they are recognised. There's actually a bit of anticipation here in Australia because the first big prenup case to hit the High Court is going to be heard in a few months' time. Tell me about that case, Thorne and Kennedy. It's a fascinating fact situation.
The wife is 36. The husband, who's now deceased, was around 67 the time this matter was heard. They had met through a dating website. He had been previously a father of three.
She's not an Australian, wasn't an Australian resident.
I understand she's from the Middle East. So they met, she came over to Australia, things had gone well, they were looking to marry. As I understand, the facts is that approximately 4 days before the wedding, a binding financial agreement was signed. This binding financial agreement hadn't been very generous to the wife. She had received advice to not sign that document. They did subsequently marry and she did subsequently sign that document. After the honeymoon, they signed a further binding financial agreement mirroring the prior agreement.
The contract said you will receive $50,000 if the marriage goes over 3 years but ends after 3 years, but nothing if it ends earlier. And of course, these things happen. It does end, doesn't it?
That's right. So they separated in 2011.
And then she begins to fight to overturn that prenup. And
that's
then
correct.
And then he dies shortly thereafter. So now she's in a dispute with his estate, his kids.
That's right. So at first instance, the judge had set aside the agreement. It then went to the full court, which upheld the husband's appeal. And the wife is now appealing and has received special leave to appeal to the High Court to determine whether this agreement should be binding or set aside. One of the interesting aspects is whether it's the contract is void or voidable and the issue of duress. And that is something which the court is looking at as to whether it applies in the general commercial realm or is something that should be applied to, you know, something like a marriage where it's a very intimate relationship. But I think listeners should take away from this is that if you are thinking about doing a binding financial agreement, that you should do so well in advance. So don't find yourself in the situation where it is being challenged. It is ideal to look at these things well in advance.
Well, indeed, I think her argument was, look, I came to Australia with no job or support network, and then we decided to get married. And then 4 days before the wedding, I'm told, sign this contract or the wedding is off. So she says, look, that's duress.
That's right. It is a very technical argument, and it is a high hurdle for the wife to run, given that she's had legal advice as found by the, you know, the full court. So it will be very interesting to see how the High Court deals with this case.
And what did the legal advice say? Did it say, yeah, go ahead and sign, or this is no good, this contract?
Well, the legal advice was that it is not in her best interests.
But she went ahead and signed.
Correct.
So watch this space. There will be a very interesting case or decision coming down shortly. Mm. When you worked in the UK, I understand that because there were big differences between the UK and just the countries like France and Belgium just across the water, that this would often lead to something called Eurostar justice. Tell me about what that phenomenon is.
Well, what's been referred to as Eurostar divorce is that it can come down to the very minute that petitions are filed for divorce. So,
in other words, who gets to hear the case?
That's right. So there's a convention that really is first in time, it is effectively first served. And so who's seized of jurisdiction can make a huge impact. And so when you're dealing with couples who have an international heritage or an international background and may have ability to file in several different jurisdictions, you need to be aware how a court in a different jurisdiction may deal with matters. And it can be very different to how cases are heard. And so the difference between France and England, for instance, that spousal maintenance is something that's generously applied in England, but not so generously applied in France. And therefore, it can make a huge impact. And other countries, such as Brussels, a prenuptial agreement is binding. And therefore, in the UK, as you know, the courts have a discretion as to whether they're going to uphold that. So they will look at the timing of the petition, and the courts will, on the petition for divorce, will actually indicate what day and what time the divorce was effectively come into effect.
So in the case of a dissolving marriage, that you become a bit trigger happy and try to work out what's in your best interests.
That's right. And I think it's very difficult for couples to come in to see you for advice. And they may very well want to try and salvage the marriage, but they don't know what the other partner may be doing. And therefore, it sometimes puts them in a very difficult position to make a decision that has quite a lifelong consequence. But of course, if the petition is issued, you can always withdraw it. However, it's not a great start trying to solve a marriage if you're going to issue for divorce.
Terence Traynor, we've been talking about prenups. What are silver nups?
Silver nups is a concept that's been coined in the UK media. And as couples are divorcing and getting remarried, particularly later on in life, is that they want to look at trying to preserve wealth for their children. And so older couples, particularly both who tend to have assets and individually are well off, want to make sure that their children are well catered for. And so it's not uncommon now that older generations are looking at what's called the silver nup, so that they set aside money for their children in the event of a divorce.
So you actually explicitly acknowledge what will happen to the assets once you die? Is that what it is? Or is it more
on divorce. So effectively, if the parties, for instance, there was a family farm and it had been through the family for several generations, that once you marry, it will come into the marital pool, that you would be saying that I brought this into the marriage, it is a family asset, and if we should divorce, that particular asset should go to my children, and anything that we buy together or we specifically nominate as joint assets then will be available for division in accordance with the agreement.
And have those taken off here in Australia as well, presumably around family farms and what have you?
I haven't seen it, but in my experience, it is often the parents of families who are looking to pass on family assets, particularly if there's an inheritance coming up, would like for their children to enter into a binding financial agreement so that those assets are protected.
Love, life and divorce in a globalised world. Terence Traynor, thanks for speaking to The Law Report. A fascinating conversation.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
International family law expert Terence Traynor. He's special counsel with Brisbane law firm Barry Nilsson. That's the Law Report for this week. Perhaps you've been listening as a podcast available from the RN homepage or from iTunes. And if you're at the iTunes site, please do rate and review our show. It will encourage more people to get a weekly fix of legal current affairs. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to technical producer this week, Brendan O'Neill. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.